From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Speaking here at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center just days after the conclusion of a potentially historic summit meeting between the leaders of North Korea and South Korea, Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in. I'm here with Professor Tong Zhao, resident scholar at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Tong Zhao, what were your impressions of the meeting? What do you see as the major takeaways, and was there anything that surprised you?
Well, there is nothing particularly surprising in terms of the nuclear issue. We all knew before the summit meeting that South Korea wants to achieve two things over the nuclear issue. One is to make sure they have a very high-level political commitment from both national leaders to the eventual goal of disarmament, denuclearization, and that was achieved. And South Korea also wants to promote a phased approach of denuclearization. That was somewhat incorporated into the final declaration, even though the declaration said a phased approach to achieve disarmament. They didn't even put nuclear in front of that word. So there is no real surprise on nuclear issues, but given that North Korea wouldn't even put nuclear in front of nuclear disarmament, that shows North Korea is determined to keep its nuclear deterrent for the foreseeable future. That really narrows the options for U.S. President Trump. It would be harder for Trump to insist on an immediate denuclearization of North Korea. There are other surprises, I think, over non-nuclear issues. Kim Jong-un showed his personal charisma. He was humorous. He could make jokes about himself, about North Korea, the poor road conditions in North Korea. I think that all points to this North Korean leader's determination to pivot to economic development. I think North Korea also showed great interest in helping that cause. The joint declaration even mentioned follow-up measures by the two Koreas to connect their roads and railways, especially in the eastern part of the nation. And there is a report that South Korean government is already conducting a study on what additional economic cooperation measures can be taken without violating the existing UN Security Council resolutions.
So I want to come back to your points on denuclearization and on potential economic reform, but there's a lot of criticism out there about this meeting. This is not the first time that a North Korean leader has met a South Korean leader. It happened in 2000 with the North Korean leader meeting with South Korea. 2007, it happened again. And of course, this year in 2018, a lot of critics are saying, you know, we're sort of buying the same horse twice. We've been here, we've done that. Much of what North Korea has committed to in this Panmunjom Declaration, it is already committed to in the past. What is your view on what those critics are saying?
I think in a narrow sense, that's correct. North Korea is not committed to an immediate denuclearization. But in some sense, that's probably all we can achieve, realistically speaking, without starting a major war. I think the only way now to disarm North Korea is probably through a military strike. And now, you know, North Korea has been so clever. They managed to dramatically repair their relations with China. They have maintained a very good relation with Russia, and their relationship with South Korea is also improving very quickly. Under those conditions, I just cannot see how Mr. Trump would even resort to a military strike. And North Korea is also smart to pledge no additional nuclear or ICBM flight tests. And without those provocations, there is no way China and Russia would agree to any additional UN Security Council resolutions to impose extra sanctions on North Korea. In other words, the maximum pressure campaign led by the US has already reached the maximum level.
Mm.
And my personal assessment is the North Korean economy would survive under existing sanction regime. So we don't have extra leverage to force North Korea making additional nuclear concessions, to make fundamental nuclear concessions.
Mm.
So that's probably all we can achieve. The hope, my personal hope is, with that very empty political commitment to the eventual goal of denuclearization, we can start with some concrete near-term steps that can prevent North Korea from further advancing its nuclear and missile capabilities. Those steps are still meaningful, because without those steps, North Korea can still explore many options to dramatically increase and improve and perfect its nuclear and missile capabilities, making them much more survivable, useful, responsive, etc., posing a greater threat than it currently possesses in the future. So I think it's worth working on starting with those near-term steps.
Tongja, I want to get a sense from you of what your assessment is in terms of why Kim Jong-un has made this dramatic shift to diplomacy. It was just over a year ago, February 2017, that his half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, was murdered in Kuala Lumpur with a biological agent banned by the United Nations. Most believe that the North Korean leadership was responsible for that. The last nuclear test by North Korea was in September 2017. Of course, they tested the Hwasong-15 intercontinental ballistic in November. So it has not been that long of a time where we have seen provocative actions by the North Koreans. Yet, following the New Year's message by Kim Jong-un, we've seen dramatic shift in North Korea's approach. And I want to get a sense from you, what do you attribute this shift to on the Korean Peninsula? What has gotten South Korea, North Korea, and the U.S. to the table for discussions? Is it the maximum pressure campaign that you mentioned, U.S. discussions on the use of military force, or is it North Korean developments? What do you see as the primary reason?
My personal view is it's the North Koreans who have been in the driver's seat over the last couple of years, because a North Korean leader openly announced their plan beforehand. Right. At the beginning of 2017, Kim Jong-un said at the New Year's speech that in the year of 2017, North Korea would enter the final stage of preparing their ICBM test capabilities. And they did that. They conducted three successful ICBM tests. And 1 year later, at the beginning of 2018, Kim Jong-un announced, now we have achieved our goal. We have perfected our state nuclear force. And I think basically that reflects a two-staged strategy of North Korea. So in stage one, they tried everything to acquire a basic but credible nuclear deterrent capability as soon as possible. And they decided at that time to do not bother with all the negative consequences, economic sanctions, international political isolation, etc. But as soon as they achieved their minimum technical requirement, they decided to wrap up their program and moved into phase two. And so the goal is now to come back and deal with the negative consequences. The goal is to keep their core nuclear deterrent capability and on that basis to develop a normal and stable relationship with the rest of the world. So in phase one, North Korea has acquired their security needs, and now they are trying to promote their economic development.
So your analysis is the reason that Kim Jong-un has turned to diplomacy is because he feels more secure in that he has a rudimentary or basic level of deterrence vis-a-vis the United States and its allies.
I think that's the case. I think North Korea leader feels he already possesses a credible nuclear deterrent. And with that, he feels much safer, much secure, and he's more capable to exercise some self-restraint, for example, in the area of freezing his nuclear capabilities development. He might even be able to reduce the number of conventional troops deployed along the border. And he's also more capable of introducing radical economic development and reform measures.
But President Moon from South Korea has given a lot of credit to President Trump, leading the maximum pressure campaign. Supporters of President Trump in the United States, and even critics of President Trump in the United States, have given him and his administration a lot of credit for getting North Korea back to the negotiating table. Do you think that there's credit deserved there?
I think the maximum pressure campaign played a secondary role. Without the unprecedented pressure created by this campaign on North Korea, I'm sure North Korea would love to continue with additional ICBM tests to continue perfecting their technologies. But because of this pressure, North Korea has to wrap up quickly after achieving the minimum technical requirement. So I think that's the role played by sanctions and political isolation.
Now, North Korea has recently announced, as you mentioned, that they will halt all future nuclear testing. They will halt all future long-range missile tests, and that they would close a key nuclear testing facility. I want to get a sense from you, how significant are these announcements in your view?
Well, these are all measures in the direction of freezing North Korea's nuclear and missile capabilities. Without flight testing of ICBMs, North Korea wouldn't be able to test and demonstrate the reentry vehicle technology, for example. There is still uncertainty. There is debate among the expert community about whether North Korea has fully mastered the reentry vehicle technology, mm-hmm. which is very important for its ICBM to deliver a warhead to its target. But my understanding is, even though there is uncertainty, that uncertainty already provides a basic degree of deterrent. The U.S. wouldn't be able to rule out the possibility that the entry vehicle might actually work if really used. Maybe the North Koreans themselves didn't know whether their reentry vehicle worked in the previous test because North Korea had very limited capability to receive the telemetry from the warhead during the tests. So without further testing, North Korea wouldn't be able to perfect their technology. They wouldn't be able to develop more powerful ICBMs. Now their ICBMs all use liquid fuel, which is not very survivable. It makes the missile vehicle less survivable because it takes time to fuel the missile and to get it ready for firing. But if they can switch to solid fuel, that makes the missile vehicle much more movable and mobile and survivable.
Your point on this is, While North Korea can't be 100% sure that a missile with a nuclear warhead could survive reentry, at the same time, U.S. planners cannot be 100% sure that it can't survive reentry.
I think that's the magic of North Korea's nuclear deterrence. North Korea feels okay to rely on that uncertainty for deterrent. In fact, a few months ago, senior U.S. military officials already declared that they had to assume by that time that North Korea already got a fully functional nuclear deterrent.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the announcements of halting nuclear and missile tests, critics say, look, this is the easy stuff. This is low-hanging fruit. It's just North Korea trying to show some goodwill with very minor impacts on its strategic posture. What do you say to those critics?
I agree if the goal is immediate North Korean denuclearization, these measures announced and committed to by North Korea are preliminary ones. They didn't undermine North Korea's core capability to maintain a credible deterrent in the foreseeable future. But again, I don't see an alternative. I don't see how we can force North Korea to do more. In fact, one of the reasons why North Korea unilaterally made these commitments even before going into the negotiations was because I think they want to secure a meeting with the US president. A North Korean leader understands that in order for North Korea and United States to have a negotiated solution, both countries need to make major concessions, especially for the United States. The US has to accept North Korea's nuclear deterrent capability and to face the reality of a nuclear capable North Korea and to live with that for the foreseeable future. And the only chance for North Korea to make sure the US would consider that concession was to talk to Mr. Trump in person. I think North Korean leader knows that Trump, given his personality, might be persuaded into accepting less than fundamental concessions on nuclear issues for North Korea, but be happy with other concessions that North Korea might be willing to offer, such as on reducing conventional military tensions, improving political relations, releasing American hostages, improving human rights in North Korea, and promising to focus on economic development in the future.
Do you think that the North Koreans' position going into these discussions, into the Trump-Kim summit, is going to be to get the U.S. president to agree to allow North Korea to keep its current nuclear weapons capabilities?
I think that's their plan, and they therefore offered as many unilateral concessions they could even prior to the negotiations to lure the American president to this meeting.
And is it your sense the Trump administration fully understands that?
To some extent, I think they do. Of course, they want to achieve this perfect goal of immediate denuclearization. And that's why Mr. Trump and other senior officials in the government have been making all the rhetorics about resolving this in one shot. But I think they, down in their heart, they know how hard this would be. And I think they might have already prepared themselves for settling with a less ambitious agreement with North Korea.
Of course, you know, 2007 to 2009, when I was the White House rep to the six-party talks, the phrase we used was CVID, comprehensible, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization. And what you're describing would mean that the administration would have to, at least in the short term, would have to drop its demand or requirement that North Korea be willing to discuss and negotiate CVID, comprehensive, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization.
I think North Korea might still be open to commit to CVID as the eventual goal, but I don't see North Korea committing to a near-term timetable or deadline for achieving that. Of course, Mr. Trump can choose to walk out of the meeting if North Korea doesn't commit to that. But what could the U.S. do in the next step? North Korea, the U.S. wouldn't be able to impose more economic pressure. There is no real military option there. So the result would be no deal, but North Korea can then continue with further efforts to improve its nuclear missile capabilities. That would be a worse outcome, actually, for the U.S. and international community. So I think it's likely the U.S. would accept a more realistic agreement with North Korea and agree to start with near-term steps and start a long negotiating process and keep that open-ended. Hopefully something better will emerge at the end of the day.
Let's turn to China. I want to get a sense from you of the view from the Chinese leadership, the Chinese government here in Beijing. How do you think the meeting between Kim Jong-un and President Moon was received here in China?
I think it's generally very well received. you know, to begin with, the military tensions have greatly reduced. There is no real risk now of a military conflict, which is very different from just a few months ago when people are really concerned about a major war breaking out over the peninsula on Chinese doorstep. Also, the two Korean leaders made a commitment to the eventual goal of denuclearization. That's also good. North Korea is willing to take concrete steps, although limited steps, to freeze its capabilities. At the end of the day, I think China believes that the only way now to force North Korea into disarming itself is basically through a military conflict. So China is happy to promote an incremental process. So all the near-term steps committed by North Korea, I think, are welcomed by China. Of course, there is concern about the summit meeting too, because there are some small items in the joint declaration that may make China worry. One is, after the bilateral summit process concludes, what's the next step? The declaration mentioned either trilateral meetings or quadrilateral meetings. But if it is going to be trilateral meeting, that means China would be excluded.
Trilateral meeting, South Korea, North Korea, U.S.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So China...
And quadrilateral, of course, right, with China.
China might have interest in making sure we go directly to quadrilateral rather mm-hmm. than trilateral. Mm-hmm. Another thing is, I think people, I think South Korea and North Korean leaders said not only the North Koreans would close the nuclear test site, but also they would welcome South Korean and American observers to monitor this process. They didn't mention Chinese observers.
Mm.
I think that would make China a little concerned because on the one hand, this test site is very close to the Chinese border,
mm-hmm.
Making sure that it's securely closed down and no risk of radioactivity being released later is a key interest for China.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, China is an experienced nuclear weapon state. China has the technical expertise to contribute, whereas South Korea is a non-nuclear weapon state. To have observers from a non-nuclear state on a nuclear test site actually run the risk of giving the non-nuclear state experts knowledge mm-hmm. about how to conduct nuclear tests. Mm-hmm. So I think China also feels it should be included in those initial process as well.
It surprises me that on both of those issues, the North Koreans didn't make sure that China was included or involved. What, in your view, is the state of the China-North Korea relationship? Of course, it was quite strained over the last year as China joined on to the maximum pressure campaign and additional UN Security Council resolutions, and then worked very hard to implement sincerely the UN Security Council resolutions. But then this meeting between President Xi and Kim Jong-un seemed to be very warm and very friendly, almost like you had a reset in the relationship. But yet, leaving those things out of the joint statement and causing China concern doesn't seem to be, to me, to align with that, what we saw in terms of the meeting. How would you describe the relationship today?
What I heard is actually the quadrilateral meeting was proposed by the North Korean leader. So North Korea did make efforts to secure Chinese interests in this process. I agree. We have observed a reset in China-North Korea relationship. That was, I think, partially a reflection of concern, deep concern in Beijing that itself could be left out of this process,
mm-hmm.
it could lose control, it could turn out to be China becoming the enemy of everyone. You know, China was the one that put real pressure on North Korea seriously damaged this relationship with North Korea. And now suddenly North Korea and U.S. Getting together, setting aside their disagreement, becoming friends, etc. So China would become the one that everyone hates. So China, you know, the effort to have a very quick summit meeting between Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un reflects mutual interest in Beijing and Pyongyang to quickly repair their ties. And I think, you know, this visit by Foreign Minister Wang Yi to Pyongyang also shows China continues to take measures to further improve this relationship, making sure North Korea would consult China closely in follow-on meetings, and China would still have serious influence.
You know, in fact, after the meeting between President Xi and Kim Jong-un, Song Tao, the director of the International Department, traveled to North Korea, got a much better reception than he got last time. Foreign Minister Wang Yi, as you said, is now in North Korea, I'm assuming he's getting a readout of the meeting between the two Korean presidents. And reports are that President Xi will travel maybe to North Korea to meet Kim Jong-un after Kim Jong-un meets with President Trump. So the Chinese leadership really seems to be opening the aperture in terms of its engagement with North Korea. And, you know, to some extent, I have to believe that is indicative of a large amount of strategic unease by the Chinese side in terms of their concern about how all of this diplomacy might turn out. You've talked about the region here in the northeast part of Asia as one that is full of deep and fundamental mistrust among the different players. And you've described how it leads each player to sort of balance off the other to get some strategic advantage. Can you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting to observe how Chinese view towards North Korea has evolved over the past few months. Originally, you know, the view was China shouldn't take the lead in punishing North Korea. That will only damage China-North Korea relationship. China was more sympathetic about why North Korea wants to have nuclear weapons for security regime. The major disagreement was between Pyongyang and Washington. Let those guys work out their differences. China shouldn't be on the front line to punish North Korea, and therefore potentially putting China itself in the crosshair of North Korean nuclear missiles. But after this news of North Korea-U.S. summit meeting broke out, there is widespread concern within the academic community that the U.S.-North Korea relationship might quickly improve. The U.S. now actually sees China as its primary long-term strategic competitor and rival. And therefore, the U.S. might have an interest in using a nuclear-capable North Korea to contain a rising China in Northeast Asia, to let North Korea play this role of a strategic balancer in this region. As a result, the U.S. might agree for North Korea to keep its nuclear weapons and then use North Korea to contain China. So given that concern, some people, some Chinese experts start to argue, we shouldn't let the U.S. make a compromise on the nuclear issue. Actually, China should insist on non-proliferation, insist on disarmament, denuclearization. So that's very interesting to watch. That basically shows China doesn't trust U.S., doesn't trust North Korea. This contributes to this polarized view in Beijing. But I think at the end of the day, even if that concern is real and widespread, I don't see China sticking its head out and insisting on immediate denuclearization of North Korea. If the U.S. doesn't insist on that, I think what is a more likely choice for Beijing is China would also accept the reality and try to develop a closer relationship with North Korea than the North Korea-U.S. relationship, making sure North Korea doesn't have a closer relationship with United States, with the other major power. So I think for the foreseeable future, a disappointing reality would be North Korea probably would get to keep its nuclear capabilities. And this trilateral distrust among China, North Korea, United States would make this geostrategic game in this region very complicated and interesting to watch.
Fascinating. Let's turn to the upcoming summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. As we're recording this podcast, the location and even the specific timing of the summit is yet to be determined, but it is widely expected at least to take place. We haven't seen anyone sort of canceling out at this point. How do you assess the Trump administration's objectives for this meeting? How do you assess Kim Jong-un's objectives for this meeting? What could come out of it?
Realistically, I think the U.S.-North Korean summit is going to be similar to the inter-Korean summit in the sense that it's going to be a symbolic meeting. The two leaders might jointly declare a political statement to reaffirm all the right things, the principles of non-aggression, not using violence to resolve their differences, commitment to ending hostilities, and efforts to directly engage each other. I'm sure this eventual goal of denuclearization would be reaffirmed, but I just cannot see a timetable, a near-term deadline attached to that. I think if the talks go well, the U.S. might be able to talk North Korea into making more concessions on its nuclear issues. For example, in addition to freezing North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, and by the way, even for freezing its capability, there are many degrees of freezing. The U.S. can always argue for the greatest degree. In the case of the nuclear test site, for example, the U.S. can insist North Korea not only shut it down, but also dismantle the test site. There were previous cases between U.S. and Russia who worked together to dismantle their previous nuclear test sites and making sure they wouldn't be easily reused.
Of course, there are reports that this particular test site has already collapsed. What's your view on that?
I think I'm skeptical about this claim that the entire test site is unusable. I think what happened was the sixth nuclear test in September 2017 produced a particularly large yield, and therefore the main tunnel, the north portal under the mountain of Mantap, was partially damaged. There was this called cavity collapse or chimney collapse that might make this tunnel no longer usable. But again, North Koreans has worked on other tunnels under nearby mountains. There is this west portal that North Korean has been working very recently until March. And there is this south portal that they have also worked on over the past few years. There is no indicator that these tunnels are damaged. And North Korean leader himself said North Korea still has two underground tunnels they could use for additional tests. So I don't really buy this argument that North Korea simply passed on some damaged good. I think it was a political decision to stop nuclear tests because North Korea has already obtained a credible and miniaturized nuclear warhead design technology. It doesn't have to conduct additional nuclear tests. By the way, a recent development in Iran also shed some light on the North Korean case. The recently reviewed Iranian nuclear archives shows Iran originally planned to build only five nuclear bombs with a yield of 10 kiloton, So Iran only wanted 5 10-kiloton fission bomb for its deterrent. And no, in the case of North Korea, it has already conducted 6 nuclear tests. North Korea has already moved on from working on fission bomb design to a hydrogen bomb design, which is much harder for them to make a hydrogen bomb smaller and light enough for weapon purpose, which means they already felt confidence, mm-hmm. confident about their capability to make a fission bomb small and light enough. So I think North Korea has got what they need, and therefore they decided to stop nuclear tests. And so we can push them to do more, shutting down, but also dismantle the test site, and also to sign the CDBT, Comprehensive Nuclear Testament Treaty, to make its obligation legally binding. And even beyond freezing North Korea's capabilities, I think the U.S. president might be able to persuade North Korea to give up some less important capabilities. For example, North Korea's SLBM program, Submarine-Launched Ballistic Missile Program. This program, in order for it to become really useful and militarily effective, North Korea needs to put much more investment into it in the future.
Mm-hmm.
North Korean submarine program is very rudimentary, and especially North Korea faces the very capable anti-submarine warfare capabilities of the United States, Japan, and South Korea. North Korean submarines would be very, very vulnerable.
Mm.
In that case, doesn't make much military sense, doesn't mm-hmm. really contribute much to North Korea's deterrent. So I think maybe we can talk North Koreans into giving up those capabilities.
The North Koreans also are holding 3 Americans hostage, which could be on the table, I would imagine, for negotiation. There's discussions about the North Koreans allowing a U.S. Interest office to open up, potentially pledges on human rights behavior. But on the American side, what would be important for the Trump administration to put on the table to get these kind of concessions by the North?
I mean, the fundamental concession is basically accepting this nuclear reality. Doesn't insist on near-term denuclearization. That would be the fundamental concession from the United States that North Korea wishes to achieve. But even if the U.S. Doesn't offer anything else, even if the U.S. Insists to maintain all the sanctions in place, I think North Korea would be able to live with that. Its economy would work fine without facing an imminent crisis. And over time, North Korea can work on substituting its need for oil products with coal. North Korea has the technology. It only needs time to transform this technology into industrial production. And over time, North Korea can always come up with new ways to evade existing sanctions. And now it looks like South Korea is fully ready to improve their economic relationship with North Korea without violating the sanctions. So there are ways for the two Koreas to improve their economic cooperation. And China, I think, Russia possibly would also explore options of more economic relationship with North Korea without violating the sanctions. So I think from North Korean perspective, they can accept the status quo. They don't have to make the U.S. Make any additional concessions.
What, in your view, the what are the hopes of the Chinese leadership in terms of this Trump-Kim meeting, and what would be their greatest concern that about this upcoming meeting?
I think if the result is U.S. and North Korea agree to do it incrementally, starting with near-term steps, I think that would be a good and welcomed result for China. The only concern I can think of is how they plan to end the Korean War, to replace the Armistice Treaty with a peace treaty. That's important process, and China wants a seat at the negotiating table for that process.
You mentioned, the last question for you, Tong Zhao, you mentioned, you know, the economic piece of all of this. Apparently, as you referred to, Kim Jong-un said to President Moon during the summit that he would be somewhat embarrassed to invite President Moon to come to North Korea because of the poor state of the roads in North Korea, and that Kim Jong-un hoped that South Korea could help with that over time. In your view, you've talked about the North Koreans may be open to economic reforms and potentially support by the international community. But at the same time, they, to this point, have seemed unwilling to sort of open up to the outside world. Mm. How do they achieve this balance where they reform their economy, yet do that in a way that doesn't put the regime under so much pressure?
I think Kim Jong-un is a little different from his father and grandfather. He did have important overseas experience. He saw the world. And he is the first North Korean leader to raise the importance of economic development to the same status as military development. And after obtaining a basic nuclear deterrent, he has declared at the 7th plenum of the Workers' Party Congress to pivot to economic development, to shift all resources to economic development. Kim Jong-un personally has demonstrated that he can be open-minded to the Western society. He was the one that introduced Disney cartoon characters into North Korean amusement parks.
Hmm.
He was the one that welcomed American basketball player to North Korea. When the South Koreans sent this K-pop performance group to North Korea, and in that case, the North Korean said they were aware about the potential cultural impact from that performance on North Korean people, and they were okay with that. I think North Koreans certainly wouldn't open up the North Korean society and wouldn't put their political system under Western impact and influence initially. They would only want to open the economic sector.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, even if it's only in the economic sector, a more liberalized policy would gradually introduce the outside world to the North Korean people and would inevitably bring more political and social liberty to this country. Of course, North Korean leader would want to do this process very carefully and incrementally, making sure it is a well-controlled process. I think North Korea also gets confidence by observing the examples of Vietnam and China. Both countries, even today, still impose effective control in political and social domains, but they can have a relatively open economic sector.
So you think there's a possibility that Kim Jong-un could say to President Trump, I want to be the Deng Xiaoping of North Korea. Come help me and help my country develop economically.
I think he has that ambition, and I think he has that vision. I think he understands in order for North Korea to be not only sustainable, but a strong country, he has to open up its economy to connect with the international economic system.
Well, this will be an interesting summit ahead, and I hope that we can come back together and talk about the summit and where things stand after that. But thank you very much for joining China in the World podcast. I really appreciate your insights, and I know our listeners will as well.
My great pleasure.
Thank you. That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.